I know people always say to me, you know, speeches, it's depressing to hear the truth. The truth is, the truth is not depressing. The truth is empowering. Ignorance is depressing. Moshe Rabbeinu told us by the mitzvah of Hakel that the greatest dangers to the Jewish people are not external dangers. It's not external enemies. It's, the mic? Okay. I'll small order. It's not external dangers or natural disasters. For Jews, it's ignorance, apathy, and indifference. Those are the greatest dangers that Jews could never overcome. So I decided that people, you know, I get tired of people telling me, oh, this is depressing, that's depressing. You know, everybody has tiredness to the government of Israel now, to El Al, to the Plaza Hotel, something in Israel they have a complaint about. Believe me, I have many more than all of you put together, so I have to deal with it every day. So one of the things I learned, though, is this unwillingness to face reality is a great danger for us. You know, the Nevi'im were considered depressing in their time. Kierkegaard once wrote that when a king dies, his power ends. When a Nevi dies, his power just begins. Because their influence permeates not just in the time when they live, but forever. And their message is seen as negative unless you read it right. Because if you listen to what they really are saying, they're giving you a message of hope. But you got to hear it. You know, they tell a story of three guys used to get together every morning in Tel Aviv for coffee. One morning, they come in, they see the other ones there already. They said, what are you doing here? He said, I want you to know, from now on, I'm an optimist. They said, you know what, to tell you the truth, you don't look so good. He said, you think it's easy being an optimist? So, it's not easy being an optimist these days. Before I say what I want to, I think that we all owe a real debt of gratitude and Hakaras HaTov and Kvod Achsanya to Rabbi Rottenberg for hosting. There'll be an appeal later. And, so when we're called together, if Chas V'Shalom, there's a tragedy, everybody shows up. Or if you have to be mispalo for a victim of something, we show up. That's why Chazal tell us the hardest mitzvah is simcha. Even though we're commanded over and over and over again to infuse our celebrations with simcha, it seems to be the hardest thing. They even don't want to come together to celebrate. We're very good at mourning, but we're very bad at celebrating. And it doesn't matter what your political position is or where you come from and all of the issues. So this gathering takes on really special significance. Yaakov Avinu, when he convened his sons, he used two words, he'asvu v'hikapsu. He'asvu means just being in the same place. Hikapsu means coming together, a real unity. That when you're together, in a sense, beyond just the physical proximity, but really feel tied to one another, an obligation not just to those who are in the immediate room, but when we feel the tie to all of Klal Yisrael. The one precondition for every miracle that happened to the Jews throughout our history was only one thing. Achdus. When we stood Kish Echad B'Lev Echad at Har Sinai to the rescue of Russian Jews and Ethiopian Jews and Syrian Jews and Iraqi Jews and Iranian Jews, everything that everybody said we couldn't do, when there was Achdus, we could accomplish everything. And it goes back. Lo Yachulu L'daber L'Shalom. We see how far back we pay a price for the division, for the rivalry within the Jewish people. The first Beis HaMikdash, when they had a northern state and southern state, and we were divided, you see it in Josephus when he tells us how the general saw the vulnerability. The Jews, Haman, saw that he could get away with what his grandfather couldn't accomplish because we were Amufuzar and Mufarad. And the antidote was Lech Kenosis Kol HaYehudim. That when Jews come together, Yaakov Avinu said to them, after telling about all their individual characters, all characteristics, all the differences between them, he said, you are a goy ukahal goyim. How can you be both? Can you be France and the United Nations? The answer is, Mabarshim tell us that to the outside world, we have to be a goy, one nation, even if we recognize amongst ourselves that we're a kahal goyim, that we are divided, that we are one. Yish echad b'lev echad was the condition for getting the Torah. It was the condition HaKadosh Baruch Hu was looking for at Har Sinai. And every time since then, it's not a political statement to show Hakaras HaTov for a reality. A reality that defies any statistical analysis. AIPAC's amazing work, and the work that is done by all of the communities, all of the armies that Israel has been able to manifest, can't explain why Israel's there. Think of the odds. Think of all the enemies that Israel faces. Overwhelming. And yet today, Israel is moving to energy independence, water independence. It's the startup nation. Chinese visitors increased 30% this year. China and India are buying more from Israel than the United States. Every African country is running to Israel. All the Asian countries are running to Israel. Think about what the change was from six decades ago. Do they still have Tsaras? Yes. But you want to see good news? You think about all these amazing things, there's no way to explain it except Yad Hashem. There's no rational political analysis. There's no computer algorithm that can explain why Israel survived these 66 years. And it not only survived, but we can honestly say it thrived. Baruch Hashem, 8.2 million people, 75% Jews, 66% of the people in Israel light candles Friday night and make Kiddush. You might think that they're all Chilonim and they're all bad guys, and you know the new poll shows that they think of Haredim much more than Haredim think of them. That more than 70% say they want a Haredi neighbor and that they're not bothered, and all of the rumors and all the stories and all the things meant to divide us were befuddled by this poll, not by from sources. So those who say Israel's isolated, let me tell you, it ain't true. And perhaps Israel's security situation is the best because there's no country in the world that can challenge Israel today. Syria can't. Iraq can't. Egypt can't and doesn't want to. Many of the other Arab countries don't want to, and I'm going to talk about it in a minute and what I experienced myself in those Arab countries and how we see Hina Hapachu. We're living Purim because when you see the change in attitude, who can deny what Rav Nirya said about Atbash, where he points out that, you know, when we take the days of Pesach, you take Aleph Tov, the first day of Pesach is always Tisha B'Av, Beis Shavuos, but there was never a match for Zion, which is Ayin. Yom HaTzmut always falls on the same day as Zion of Pesach. You don't want to accept it? You don't have to. But it's a reality. You know that the Admor Mirijin told the story about Rav Kook, that when the San Remo Agreement, which I think you mentioned, was signed in 1920, he came to a festive celebration in his Bigday Shabbos. So people on certain extremes started making fun of him for it and ridiculed him. And he answered, Kol HaMisabel al Yerushalayim, those who mourn Yerushalayim, Zocha Baroah, the Simchasa, will see its joy. So they say, why doesn't it say Bivinyana, that we'll see its rebuilding? And he answered that everybody can see buildings. Only those who are Mesaba will see the true Simcha. Abraham Avinu was made to go through such difficult circumstances. He was told Lech Lecha when he was told to go for the Akedas Yitzchak. It was a difficult trek. Why couldn't he just tell him? But he doesn't say where you're going. He said, I'll tell you which mountain in a little while, but you go there. When he told him to leave his city, his country, to go to Eretz Yisrael, he didn't tell him, El Aretz Ashareka, I'll tell you later on where you're going. And why did he have to trek around and do these things and not be told where he was going? To come to the place, the most holy place, the place where HaKadosh Baruch Hu reveals himself in a way that no other place in the world, in Yerushalayim, when he comes to Har HaBayis, and you remember he says to Eliezer and to Yishmael, what do you see? And they say, well, we see a place, mountain. He said to Yitzchak, what do you see? And he said, I see a holy place. And he said to Yishmael and Eliezer, you stay here with the donkey because you see what the donkey sees. How many of us see what the donkey sees? How many of us are not ready to see the reality and the opportunities? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu makes Avram go through all of these iterations, to go to all of these places. He tells him Lech Lecha. He uses this powerful language, the double language. Because he understood that you have to anticipate, that you have to look forward, that if he had given it to him, media wouldn't have appreciated it. That it was only by the build-up and by getting him inspired about what it would mean for him to come eventually to this place, to this very special place. How many of us take Yerushalayim for granted? You all go there and say, look what we built, look what we have. You know that throughout the ages, the anti-Semites used to yell, hep, hep, hep. It stands for Jerusalem et Perdita. From the time of the Romans to the Nazis, they said, hep, hep, Jerusalem et Perdita, because there was no way to diminish the Jews, to embarrass the Jews, than saying to them, you lost Yerushalayim. Why is it that they understand it? You know, there was a gathering of 42 Arab countries in Jordan and Amman for a group called ISESCO, Islamic Society for blah, 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 blah. But they don't know either what it stands for, so it's okay. 42 countries in the middle of the Arab volcano. And you know what the agenda was? That Harabias is really, that the Kotel is really Al-Barak's wall, named for Muhammad's horse who ascended after him, one end or the other. That Kever Rachel is really named for the driver of Muhammad. And remember, Muhammad never visited Israel in his lifetime. And that Maras HaMachpelah is only a mosque. So you think, don't they have more important things to do than to try and deny history? Why did Arafat keep saying there were no Batei Mikdash? I mean, it's a repudiation of Christianity, not just Judaism. What was he doing? Why did they do it? And present was UNESCO's leader. So you think, they look at this, for 3,000 years, it was called Kutab Rachel, Rachel's tomb. Never, ever called anything else. Because they understand better than us that if you take away our past, you take away our future. If you cut us off and say, you had no place here, this isn't your Kotel, this is Al-Barak's wall. You know, today, if you look at UN documents, it says Western Wall / Al-Barak's Wall. Kutab Rachel / Mosque of whoever the driver was, some taxi driver. Why is it that they know, that they see it? How many of you spend time with your kids when you see a report in the paper that says that there were amazing discoveries in Yerushalayim? Every single day, there are amazing discoveries as they do the excavations at Ir David, at the tunnels, at the Minarota Kotel, at other places. Do you see what they found? You take a Tanakh, it's a GPS now there. Just open it and look. I take Goyim there, they jump out of their skins. I take Jews there, they say, that's nice. When they found that little gold ball, I used to show the picture to Jewish audiences, prim audiences, but I got embarrassed because nobody knew what it was. It fell off the gown of a coin going over into the Beis HaMikdash. Did you sit there and say to your kids, you want to know, you want to believe, you want to be a mom, and here's the proof? Why did HaKadosh Baruch Hu hide it for 2,000 years and give us the chus to see it? And next to it, they found a little rock. Carved on it was the menorah. And it solves all the disputes about high base, low base, all the things. Because we have a picture of it. Did you say to your kids, do you see what they're showing when they found Shaarim where David fought Goliath? Did you tell them when they opened up and they say, here's where David HaMelech's palace probably was? When we found mikvahs that are exactly the same as ours from 2,000 years ago, that they found tefillin now in Qumran that were sitting for all these years in the shrine of the book, and now all of a sudden we see that we have this connection, that they wore the same tefillin 2,000 years ago. You think your kids would understand that? Do you ever take the time to talk to them about it? Every shovel going in the ground as they built the light railroad uncovered more and more and more of our past. Every time Arafat tried to desecrate the Harabayas, all it did was uncover our past. You know, they took out shovel at 400 tons, which really, because a guy came to my office and he dumped a garbage bag on my desk. I said, what are you doing? I said, a more colorful way. What are you doing? And he said, he said, go through it. And I found these shards from Second Temple period, First Temple. I said, where's this from? And he said, I found it in the old city dump in Yerushalayim. And they took all of it to Yair Yerushalayim, and they've been going through it for 10 years, and they're going to go through it for another 10 years, and they found the most amazing things, including a coin minted in the Beis HaMikdash with the name Eliyahu on it, and the burn marks around it. And every bone that was found in the area Arafat desecrated came from a kosher animal. Not one from a treif animal. Everything HaKadosh Baruch Hu is showing it to us every day, saying, guys, I'm showing you it. How much more can I do to get you to realize you're tied to the past to understand your responsibilities to the future? You can't take it for granted. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given us nisim that no generation had in 2,000 years. Tell me, you witnessed the prophetic vision in your lifetime of Kibbutz Goliath. Do you realize it? You pray for it, but you witnessed it. Did you think about it? Jews of Russia coming home. The Jews of Yemen coming home. The Jews of Ethiopia coming. The Jews of Iran. The Jews of Iraq. Jews of Syria. It's Kibbutz Goliath. And we say, you know what? It's good, but they're a burden. You know, sometimes they get in the way. We don't like the way they park and other things. As Yomu Vagayim, Higdel Hashem Lasos Im Eila, Higdel Hashem Lasos Simono, and the Sefer Note tells us that this applies to Kibbutz Goliath. You say it in benching. Do you ever think what that Shir Malas means? That the Goyim are saying, if God to God, if you would only treat us like the Jews, we would be happy. What they need, pogroms, inquisitions, holocaust, what do they want? The answer is they look at the world today and they say, who has miracles in the world? Does France have miracles? Does India have miracles? All the miracles happen to the Jews. You take this little country whose name hardly fits on the map. Everybody thinks it's the fourth greatest power in the world and sometimes greater than China, but it's working on it. Ask people in the streets. Ask the kids in the colleges how big Israel is. You think anybody will say it's smaller than Connecticut? Believe me, not one. So we come back to the message that we're getting in every generation. You know, the first Rashi, you all know, why do they have it? Why didn't they start with Rosh Chodesh? Because of Listim Atem and all the rest. Hirsch says, Listim Atem, that we say when the Goyim will say, you were robbers, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave this land to us through all time, through a contract that is bound, no Nazi, no power, nobody could ever break it. Hirsch says, no, the problem is that the Goyim is saying it. It's when Jews have doubts. That's the danger. When Jews aren't willing to stand up, when we're not convinced, when we're not willing to be proud and to assert it. You know, I speak every year for the Christian Society for Israel conference in Washington. 5,000 people, the most dedicated, most amazing people. I only wish that Jewish audiences had 1% of the Islamists that these people have when you talk about Israel. I'm not kidding, and I know there's somebody here who attended. I saw him walking in before. And I ended the speech by saying, how many of you know, can name the 10 scouts, because I said in Washington you can't say spies, who came back with a negative report? 4,990 people silent. I said, who can name the two who came back with a positive report? And 4,990 people were standing on their chairs yelling, Joshua and Caleb, Joshua and Caleb, Joshua and Caleb. I said, that's the lesson of history. Those who speak against Israel are written off to history. Those who stand with Israel are remembered forever. For 10 minutes, they cheered, they screamed, they yelled. You think Jewish audiences ever think about it? You think they would react with the same thing? You know that the only power that can defeat the Jews is the Jews. Look at all the enemies throughout our history. Where are they? They're all gone. They've all disappeared. They're not here anymore. They've been defeated. They've been erased. Only one people today is in the same land, speaks the same language, has the same religion as their ancestors 3,000 years ago. Only one. And it's the only one whose credentials are challenged in the United Nations every year. Not some little island in the Pacific with 30,000 people and the next tsunami erases it. They get accredited every year. But only Israel is challenged. A state sanctified by 3,000 years of tefillahs, tears, prayers, sacrifices. So what are we asked to do? We ask so little of us. One is that we stop the internal rivalries. The Goyim learned from us. They learned to exploit our weaknesses. They test us all the time. Yaakov Kamenetsky once said on Behisha Amda, he said, "You mean to tell me there wasn't one generation that didn't have it? There must have been one generation. B'chol dar v'dor omdim aleinu b'dor. There wasn't one generation that didn't have it?" He said, "Now look at the next paragraph in the Haggadah, which is Se'umad. And Laban b'kesh la'kar sakol." Here was Yaakov Avinu thinking he was living, he had a good life, he was moving ahead. And all the time, Laban was plotting against him. So in the generations that think that we're immune to it, that it's not here, it can't happen here, it can happen everywhere. It is happening everywhere. It's just not always visible. We see the campaign today, no different than the campaign of 70 years ago to delegitimize Jews. It's called BDS, Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions. It's called the Delegitimization Campaign. If you want to understand why we have to stay and sit tonight and remember the 23,138 people who died in the defense of Israel, because they died for us as well. And you know who reminds us of it? They do. Because the campaign isn't against Israel. Israel is the collective Jew. That 70 years after the Shoah, you can't say yet, "I hate Jews," but you can say, "I hate Israel and I hate Zionists." Who do you think they mean? And we saw it in France, 17,000 people demonstrating, and all of a sudden, kick the Jews out of France. Jews out of France. You know, I recently met the Médecins Sans Frontières, the medicine, the Doctors Without Frontiers, from who are working in Syria. Because, I met with Assad right before the fighting, so I met some of the guys, and since then they keep in touch. And said to me, all of a sudden we saw the sharp increase in French fighters, young men from France coming. So they asked them, "What are you doing here?" And they said, "We're Mohamed Mara fighters." You know who Mohamed Mara was? The guy who killed three little Yinglish at the school in Toulouse. Hundreds of French guys came to Syria to die, to fight, because they were Mohamed Mara fighters. And now we have thousands from England, from France, from Holland, from Italy, from the United States. And for years I've been warning about it and trying to get the U.S. government to pay attention to it. Now, all of a sudden, everybody's waking up when we have thousands of guys trained as jihadists who have passports to come back. So they don't mean them, they mean us. They're reminding us that we're all part of Klal Yisrael, that they make no distinction between us. Today was called Yom HaZikaron. The word Zachar permeates this whole period in the calendar. Shabbat Zachar, which is for Purim. Pesach is about Zechirah, to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim. The Shoah, Yom HaShoah last week. The word symbolizing the Shoah is what? Zachar, not Nekamar. Zachar, remember. When we say a tefillah on Yisker, we say a prayer of remembrance, not a prayer of mourning. All of this, the whole period, is around the idea of Zechirah, which is not history. There's no Hebrew word for history. Jews can't be caught in a static view of the world. Zechirah is a dynamic process, which says to us that you got to look back. That's why HaKadosh Baruch Hu only let Moshe see his back, because he said, first you have, you want to understand the present, you have to look back. And throughout our history, we see the tefillos on Rosh Hashanah, Al Kain Nekaveh, we talk about our past, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us that for Jews, you have to look back in order to look forward. It's unique to Judaism, that for us, the past is about the future. Because we want to spare future generations. And if we don't look back and have the context which will enable us to understand the miracles that we're seeing today, if you're caught up just in the day, you're not going to see anything. You're going to be blind to it. And if we don't appreciate the miracles, they don't continue. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has gone to such extent and to such lengths, and he keeps saying to us, "Look, I'm showing it to you. What else do you want to see?" So now we have a BDS campaign. It is the modern version of what the Nazis wanted to do. It's no different. It is the big lie. It says that Jews don't have the rights of others. It's not about a political view. It's not 67, it's 47. It's about Israel's right to exist. It's about the right of the Jews to have a state. It's about the right of Jews to be able to have the freedoms that other people have. There is a pattern of history. And now we're seeing the modern blood libels, no different than those in the Middle Ages. And then we see the vaunted UN Human Rights Council last week passed 5 resolutions. No, not about the murder of 200,000 people in Syria, not about the massacre of Christians all over the Middle East, not about the killing of Baha'i in Iran. All 5 about Israel. And Iran got elected to the Human Rights Commission, to the Status of Women Commission, and the Commission on NGOs working on human rights. But they weren't alone. Sudan also, which is massacring tens of thousands of people, Syria, a few others, all of them in good company. What we're seeing is the old isms of the past. Churchill once said, the further back you look, the further ahead you will see. Our Chazal said it 1,000 years earlier. They built it into the way we celebrate our Chagim. Why? To remind us, to give us a perspective, a context. That's what enables us to see what other people don't see. We're seeing the isms of old. You know, they tell the story of the Jew, an old man was driving on a little motorcycle and came up in Israel next to a Lamborghini, stopped at a light, and he sees Doc on the license plate, and he says, "Hey, Doc, that's a beautiful car." He said, "Yeah, it cost me $250,000. He said, "How fast does it go?" He said, "Well, I can get it up to 80 in a minute and to 120 in 2 minutes." He said, "That's a beautiful car. Can I look inside?" And he said, "All right." And the old man squeams over and he squirms inside the car. And all of a sudden, the doc says, "You know, when this light changes, I'm going to show him what the car can do." And he takes off. And he looks at the old man sitting at the light still. And all of a sudden, the old man passes him. He gets really upset. He puts his foot to the pedal, goes faster. The old man left behind, again, he passes him. So he really floors it. And he looks back and he sees the old man coming up and smashes into the back of the Lamborghini. The doctor jumps out and he said, "Is there anything I can do for you?" He said, "Yes, could you untie my suspenders from your mirror?" Sometimes it's how I feel, that we're looking in the rearview mirror at things we thought we left behind, and all of a sudden, they're coming at us again. Which tells you also wear a belt, not suspenders. And what we were premised for the promise for the 20th century was a new world order, and we've gotten old world disorder. Look at the anti-Semitism in Europe, rising in every country. Half of Europeans express anti-Semitic views. There's 150 million anti-Semites. We have the Jobbik party in Hungary. You have the Golden Dawn. You have the Le Pen party. You have the Wilders party in Holland. All over Europe, we're seeing the rise of extremist parties, left and right, with the old anti-Semitic messages built in. What's the difference is that we have a Jewish state. Think of where Europeans would be. Frankly, there is no future for European Jews. Some of you heard me say it the last 10 years. I say it again. I say it to all the European Jewish communities, get the hell out now. You've got to get out, just like we try to get the Jews of Iran to leave. They don't listen, but we still have a job to tell them. And unfortunately, very few people listen. Martin Luther King once said, "We're not going to be judged by the attacks of our enemies, but by the silence of our friends." And all of us have to think about what our crisis is. At a time when we see all of these rises of anti-Semitism, including in the United States, as we saw in Kansas City and in many other places, there has to be zero tolerance for intolerance to Jews. No more memorials. I'm sick and tired of memorials to dead Jews. I want people to stand up for living Jews and a vibrant living Jewish state. That's the measure today. I won't go much longer. I just wanted to talk about one other thing, and that is two things, actually. One is the Arab volcano. This is not an Arab Spring. This shows you the distortion and the misrepresentation. With the information revolution, let me just tell you, you can't believe anything you read, except the Hamotia, you got Ted. You know. You can't believe what you hear. You can't even believe what you see. Mark Twain once said, if you don't read a newspaper, you're ill-informed. If you read a newspaper, you're misinformed. Today it is true. And it's true in so many ways. You know that they found sharks off the coast of the Sinai, and they said that these were Mossad trained to try and kill people and stuff. So they captured him and trained and put him on trial, and they convicted him. Saudi Arabia captured a vultures that were coming over and had been tagged by Israel to check the migration pattern. They captured it. Last week, Victor was released because I found out he's a bird, not a drone. Iran, not to be outdone, captured squirrels, which they were convinced were Mossad trained to infiltrate their nuclear program, and they executed them. Everything I just said is true. Everything. You laugh, hundreds of millions of people believe it. They're fed it on Al Manar and Al Jazeera and Al Hura and all of the rest. They believe it. And today the difference is that the big lie can spread in seconds, not in months, as it took Hitler. The haters understand only one message, and that's strength. And they probe for weakness. The Arab volcano had nothing to do with democracy. I've been in Egypt 4 times. I was there right after the revolution. I've been in almost all of the countries. And as I said, I met Assad just a month before the fighting began. And I came back and I told President Obama when the fighting began, listen, guy, this guy's not going anywhere. He told me, if it comes here, I will never step down. Because I will get out, but they'll kill them Alawites, my people. They'll massacre them because I know how much they hate him. And the leaders in every country told me, it has nothing to do with democracy. You want democracy, fine. This had to do with food, with jobs. 50% of the people in Egypt make less than $2 a day. Unemployment, 40%. Same thing. You remember, it began in Tunisia with the burning of a car. It's about failed states. Syria is not a country. Syria was created by the Sykes-Picot, by the European party. They have nothing in common. They're Kurds, they're Alawites, they're Sunnis, they're Shiites, they're Christians, they're Houthis, they're everything, but they ain't Syrians. Libya is 147 tribes. It's not a real country. Egypt's a real country. That's why the army could do it, because they have an Egyptian identity. Moroccans have a Moroccan identity. Most of the others are not real countries. So there's nothing to hold them together except the dictator. And most of all, you'll never understand what's happening if you don't see this, that this is a battle between Sunni and Shiites for control of the Middle East. This is a battle of 1,000 years standing. When you look at the fight in Syria, you look at it and you think it's between rebels and Assad. First of all, the rebels killing other rebels who are killing other rebels. Yesterday, 62 people died, all rebels killing rebels. There are 106 rebel groups fighting in Syria today. None of them are good guys. I met today with one of the leaders of the opposition from Syria and one from Iran, who are good guys. They have nothing to say about what's going on. Syria is Sunni versus Shiite. It's Kurds versus everybody. It's U.S. versus Russia. It's Turkey versus Iran. It's Qatar versus Saudi Arabia. You can't peel that onion enough to understand how many layers of conflict there is. And yet the media presents it to you. Oh, this is the Arab Spring, you know, new things, good things going to happen. This is as far from spring as anything can be. The difference is that today we live in an age of superficiality. Nobody has patience for Zikhira. Nobody has time for history. Our kids don't have time for history. They want everything done. You know, a game, they see it, they have to be done in 30 seconds, a miniseries, nothing more. But that's not how the world works. Our kids don't know. They can't answer. And they become vulnerable. Because none of you take the time to sit down. And this guy challenged me when I give this speech in Flatbush every year. And he said, how can you say it? I am my yeshiva kids, we take them to Israel, all that. He waited for me outside of Rabbi Frankel's shul, and he said, at mincha the next day. And he said, at lunch today, I talked to my kids about 1948, and my 16-year-old yeshiva bachar said, what are you talking about? We took it from the Palestinians in 48, didn't we? Don't say shh, because your kids will say the same thing. How many of them can really answer and know and be able to defend against these accusations? That's what the anti-Semites exploit. The ignorance, the apathy, and the indifference. And the fact that we live in a totally superficial time when people don't want to know. They don't want to be, it's not comfortable to be told all these things. You know what? It's the reality. Vayoreu osana mitzrim. The Egyptians did wrong to us, not wrong. They wronged us. Why wronged us? Because first they had to show the Jews were responsible for all the ills. What did Hitler do? He wronged the Jews. He showed the Jews responsible for all the problems. Then he could introduce the final solution. And it was actually the Mufti of Jerusalem who introduced the concept. You know, it's a Gemara that says, "Kala Omer Yerushalayim Lomar Klum." It always used to bother me. What does it mean? If you say Yerushalayim, you haven't said anything. It means that if you simply said, "Lashana Ababa Yerushalayim," at the end of your Seder, or at Ne'ilah, and you do nothing else the rest of the year, then you haven't said anything because you don't mean it. We are being judged. Our grandchildren are judging us. Just as we judge a generation of 70 years ago and ask what did they do. They said they didn't know. It's a lie. They didn't want to know. We know from all the ally documents that are being revealed, and we only know a small percentage. We learned this year there were 42,000 Nazi installations, work camps, concentration camps, labor camps in Europe. 42,000. You think anybody didn't know? We found the documents that were collected, big tapes done of Nazi officers captured in Britain. And just by chance, some scholar found it locked away, that Jewish refugees had it transcribed, and they were describing in there how they killed the Jews every morning, sending 1,500 out before breakfast to do target practice with them. It wasn't that people didn't know, they didn't want to know. But today you know everything. You know the challenges to Israel. You know the challenges to Jews. You see the anti-Semitism rising. You see the BDS campaigns on our campuses, Jewish students being given expulsion notices. What do you do about it? How do you stand up? That's the test. Are we going to demonstrate the Achdus and bring Yidden together? Uvachart Avachayim is not for us, it's for our children and our grandchildren. Hirsch says, no generation is judged in time. We're not judged by our children, we're judged by our grandchildren. Because that's really when you see come to fruition the actions you take and undertake, the commitments you make. Our grandchildren will judge us just as our grandparents will, whether we learned the lessons of the past and understand our obligations to the future. Uvachart Avachayim. Sometimes it's not a rational choice. When Jews came out of the Holocaust, for them to start new lives was not a rational choice. The choice of life you make every day, you don't even think about it. You're not conscious of it. How many times a day you make choices of life for you, your children, your grandchildren, and their grandchildren? The Torah tells us there's two things that are a morasha as opposed to a yirusha. Yirusha is something a rich uncle leaves you. It's yours. You do with it what you want. Two things are a morasha, Torah and Eretz Yisrael. It's given to us in trust for future generations. It's our job to make sure they're safe. So you don't like the politics, you know what? You'll find other ways to give expression to that. But you can't avoid your obligation. If you care about your children, if you care about your grandchildren, then you'll find a way, each according to their means, each according to their ability. They can join APAC, they can join many other organizations. Don't join that one. But you can join many others and find ways. The OU has a public affairs institute. Many others have. Aguda has things. Everybody has ways that we can find to give expression. I sat with one of the Gedolei Hadar in Eretz Yisrael just recently. And he asked me to come back after my meeting with him because some official was coming. And he asked me if I would sit with him. So I did. And with him was a young guy. And this young guy wanted to engage this gadol, and finally started talking about guys learning in Litta or someplace, I don't remember where because I wasn't paying attention. And the gadol said to him, what are you talking about? How many people do you think were learning full-time there? He said, you think there were 5,000? You think there were 500? There weren't 50. And he said, how many do you think were learning in all of Europe full-time? And he said, and 150,000 guys are learning here in Israel full-time. And this young guy looked at me and said, is the Rosh Yeshiva saying that this is a Medina Shel Chesed? And he said, of course it's a Medina Shel Chesed. I just told you 150,000 guys are learning here. So whatever time is you have, remember, it's a Medina Shel Chesed. And it's doing Chesed for all the Eden, for all of us. Think of what our lives would be like, Chas V'Shalom, if we didn't have it. And all of us have to take advantage of this moment to be a Nachshon, to take that leap of faith, to take the action. And at Davar Toleh Bi, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is telling us, I did all these miracles for you. Dabera B'nei Yisrael B'Yisom. Now's the time for each of us to lift ourselves up, to make a decision, to support, to give money, to help, to get involved, and to educate your children.